Hello, welcome to Human Tech, a podcast about the intersection between humans and technology. My name is Guthrie. I am here with Susan. Hello.
Hi, Guthrie.
How are you doing today?
I'm good. The sun is out.
Well, that always, yeah.
Puts me in a good mood. You know that.
Yeah, we got no sun here. So today's topic is about UX tool versus process. I can workshop the name. Maybe tool versus methodology. We have heard complaints about sort of UX in general, and we've talked about a lot of them.
We never get complaints about UX, she said facetiously.
Oh. One of them being, the pace of Agile, some of them being lack of resources. One thing that we haven't particularly talked about, and this is maybe... it's interesting because we straddle the line between UX research and UX design. We talk a lot about strategy. I would say our we have one foot in research and one foot in strategy. And we of course know design, but compared to people who are real UX designers or visual designers, we're maybe a step removed from that.
Yeah.
But it is true, and we have mentioned it before, and we will continue to mention it. Now, a lot of people, when they say UX, they actually mean UX design, or even what you would consider is not even UX, but visual design.
Right.
The make it pretty. And we it's a problem that we have talked about before, which is like I just want you to make it pretty, which is, not what UX is, right? UX is not just about the aesthetic of it. It's much, much more than that.
So that's not even what visual design is, but okay.
Right. So you have term creep as slowly visual, and not to say that every company that is doing visual design is a make it pretty shop, but it's a complaint that sometimes UXers can kind of feel. All right. So that's like off to the side. But yep. One of the things that has happened because of that and because of so much engineering work that has required so many screens to happen is that even if it's not the, okay, just go make it pretty, a lot of the, I would say the percentage of UX work that is solely focused on the design side in some capacity or another has increased over the years. Would you agree with that? Like, what do you think the percentage was of research? Let's keep strategy out of it because that's sort of hanging above. But 20 years ago, what do you think was the breakdown between strategy, or sorry, between design and research? And what do you think it is today, just based on number of man hours, not necessarily importance?
Well, okay, wait a minute. But by design, which definition are you using?
I'm going to use your definition. And if you want to do a breakdown, okay, I'll give you three, okay?
Okay.
What percent is interaction design / visual design? What is what you would traditionally call UX design?
Yeah.
And then what is research? And give me the breakdown in terms of just raw man hours 20 years ago and then today.
Ooh, that's an interesting question. Okay. So I would say
I should say you would know, as at one point you were chief of technical staff of a major UX consultancy firm doing, soup to nuts UX work, big huge projects. Yeah. So you are somewhat qualified to answer this, at least in terms of what it was, since you were doing a lot of big UX projects.
True user experience work versus what we would call UI / visual work versus research, right?
I would like to say I think that's a little bit of a slander to call it true UX work. I think that's a little biased.
Am I showing my bias?
You can maybe say traditional
user experience work versus UI / visual work versus design.
Yeah.
20 years ago versus today,
or some other. I mean, doesn't it? I just kind of picked 20 at random.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you'd prefer to do
10 or 15. We can do 20. So
Again, this is just raw man hours, people hours.
I would say back 20 years ago or so, I would say that 10% was research and 60% was UI / visual and 30% was UX.
Okay, what do you think it is today?
Today, I would say 20% is research. I think the research doubled. I would say that 10% is UX and 70% is UI / visual.
So what was the change in UX, traditional UX work?
That was what got lost. It went from 30 down to 10.
30 down to 10. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, right, there's some interesting stuff there. I mean, on one hand, I think this is happening a lot with the UX industry, right, where it's harder to get into UX than ever before, but there's more UX work than happening ever before, and so that's, like, strange. And on one hand, you have more of the make it pretty, less about the actual UX than ever before, but also way more research than ever before.
Yeah.
So it's right. So it is becoming more technical and less technical at the same time, sort of in a complex way. It's not a great storyline. It's not like we can just be like, all right, here it is. We lost the analytical side, and it's all run by a bunch of artists. That's not really true. But okay, so we'll just run with those numbers.
Okay.
So there is no doubt that the work that is much closer to the final product is increasing, right? The fidelity level is increasing, and you have this huge surge in visual design that's happening.
Yeah.
And one of the side effects of that, and you can tell me if you think I am wrong or not, is that... and it happens in a lot of different industries, is tool use versus the methodology, or versus the I don't know. I like I said, I need the right word for the title. I don't have it yet.
Well, what do you mean by tool use?
So, for example, one of the complaints that we have heard is that a lot of UXers feel that they are stuck primarily in these days in Figma, that UX has basically been boiled down to creating things in Figma, much in the same way that I suppose if you were... this is a terrible analogy, but we'll just run with it. Like, if you were, let's just say that you're like a landscaper, right?
Okay.
And there's this whole art to it with pH levels and this and, what's the aerating dirt and all this stuff.
Okay.
But, it turns out that 98% of your job is just like wheelbarrowing, dirt,
putting a plant in.
Yeah, right. Like, so even though there's this whole more advanced kind of thing, the world that exists, the reality is that even if you are a highly trained landscaper, it may turn out that in the wrong job, your actual work is just moving a wheelbarrow of dirt around 1,000 times. And so one of the complaints that we have heard in the UX world, which again, which I want to talk about, is that the whole body of knowledge of UX and being a practitioner of UX has basically been just, that's nice, but the job that we'll say 8 out of 10 UXers have, 7 out of 10 UXers. Yeah, 7 out of 10, because you said, you know, 70%. 7 out of 10 UXers have is just being a Figma prototyper, basically. Like that is your job.
Yeah,
and it's really tool specific. So yes. All the things you would need to know as a UXer are basically how to use Figma, how to use the tool, and it's very tool forward as opposed to, well, tool agnostic, you know, methodology focused.
Yeah.
For example. So well, that is the kind of the big complaint, and hopefully you understand.
I might use a different framework, which would be doing high level design versus detailed design.
No, but, I know, but I want to move away from that too, because the complaint, I mean, we talked about that before, and that's sort of the ode to traditional UX. I think that battle, I mean, yes. Yes.
Okay.
But I'm going even one further. Like, yeah. Imagine like back in the day, if you were going to design a button, okay, that's high fidelity, but you would maybe sketch some concepts out. You'd maybe use this. You'd maybe do that. Like, your job wouldn't necessarily involve only just
Figma to make the button.
Figma to do it, right? Whereas now your job is 90%. I mean, even if you were doing high fidelity work in the past, you know, it was maybe different. Whereas now, a lot of people are doing high fidelity work, and it's always just Figma work.
Well, I mean, I think it's, yeah, you're right. And I, you know, there's a part of me that's like a very small part. That's just like, oh, just let it go. This is where we are. This is the reality. You know, don't be the complaining person who talks about, well, back in my day it was and so I'm sensitive to that, but I have to say, you know, that's like one half of 1% of me, because the other 99.5% of me is like, wake up. Guys, because it's, you know, you talked about the fact that, you know, UX people, and they complain that they're just expected to use the tool. But the problem I see is that there's a lot of UX people that aren't complaining about it either, because it's so accepted. It's become so accepted that, I mean, UX to me is just being forgotten. And people, even people who have a master's degree in human-computer interaction, who should remember about UX, even they have just fallen into UX means design the screen in Figma. And, you know, you've got product managers and product designers and product owners that in my recent experience the whole idea of what UX is and what it means and what it brings to the table, it just does not exist for them. It is Figma. And that's, if you talk to them about, you know, well, what should we take some time and talk about the UX, they would just like, what, you know, what do you mean? You're designing the screens. So no, seriously.
And I should say, you mentor. You do mentoring, and so some of the people you are mentoring are living this life.
Right, but the scary thing for me is that some of the people I'm mentoring have the same mindset. There seems to be a collective amnesia among those who used to get it. I mean, with the big explosion in design and in development and in creating all this stuff, you had this whole group of people come up through the ranks from a wide variety of backgrounds who are in charge of product design, product management, product ownership. And my opinion, you guys can let us know if you don't agree, My opinion is very few of those people have a background in UX. Very few of them have a background in UI and visual design either. So they aren't thinking about UX stuff at all. But you also have this whole group of people that have come up doing the UI and visual design, and they don't think about UX either. So, and then you have this group of people, like I said, I mentor people. They have degrees in what I think is UX, and they've forgotten anything. You know, I start to think they probably had a couple of courses, one or two courses in college or grad school that was really about UX, and they forgot it all. And they're, you know, I got to remind them. So it's, I try not to get depressed or defeatist about it, but it's really amazing to me how much is kind of lost right now, which, you know, what's happening is everybody, whether they know it or not, and whether they're getting sued for copyright infringement or not, everybody's basically just copying what everybody else is doing. You know, we all use apps and we all use screens. And so, oh, here's what this should, oh, here's a login screen, here's a dashboard, here's a, you know, a table, here's a this, here's a that. And so they just don't think it's necessary because they're just kind of doing what they see. And yeah, I think the result is poor and boring interfaces, but you know, that often don't work the way you want them to.
Well, look, I think part of it as well, if we're talking about Figma in particular,
yeah,
is what's the output, you know? And I think the output has changed, because the output in a lot of places now is a Figma file.
Yeah, definitely.
Right. So like, why waste time and have to do another translation layer when you can just do all the work in Figma and then you don't have to translate at the end, because that's what the output is supposed to be. It's a, you know, in the same way that like, if the output of, well, that was a bad example in my head.
So. No, but you're right. I think we don't always realize how much the tool is affecting our thinking. Let's use a different analogy. Let's use a different tool. You know, I talk to people a lot about, you know, creating a presentation, right? And this is an interesting problem we have too. The tools are dictating. So, you know, it used to be that everybody always used PowerPoint for presentations, or Keynote. Remember Keynote? Is Keynote still around?
Of course, it's still around. You just don't have a MacBook anymore.
I don't have a Mac anymore.
I think a lot of the Mac apps they had like a moment.
Yeah.
But then I think anyone who needed to use Microsoft for their office workplace continued to do that. And the Microsoft apps for Mac got better. And then anyone who would maybe use Keynote or would maybe use whatever, a lot of those people kind of transitioned, I think, to Google Workspace.
Yeah.
Or what, you know.
But my point is,
I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of people who still use Keynote.
If you have a tool for giving a presentation, PowerPoint, Keynote, whatever, you know, and someone says, oh, I got to create a presentation. So they open up the tool and they start creating the presentation in the tool. So, you know, they're not thinking about the presentation. They're just thinking about using the tool, and the tool is dictating to them what the presentation should be like. And these days I see people doing presentations, you know, with the people who are really into Figma, they've started doing their presentations in Figma. they do.
Yeah.
And they don't understand why that's, they should. So,
right. So, I mean, this is the question, right? Is UX simply just Figma?
The tool.
Is Figma the tool?
Who love Miro boards and mural boards they do their presentations in Miro, in Mural. So yeah, we get really attached to that tool because we spend hours and hours and hours in it, and it becomes the way we do everything. And you know, maybe that's not a bad thing a lot of the time, but if that tool, you know, it can limit you, and it can put you in one way of thinking. You know, you're in the Figma box, you're in the Miro box, and it hampers, you know, I think it definitely hampers. You know, it's especially interesting because when I've been mentoring recently and I want people to, you know, we're talking about design, and I'll say, well, what about the task flow? You know, do you have a task flow? And then they'll immediately start trying to create a task flow in Figma, you know, and then they start, and then they spend an awful lot of time drawing boxes and arrows and stuff because they're just focused on, oh, what's the best way for me to do this in Figma? And, you know, I'm like, could we not? Could we just stop using Figma? Just stop for a moment. Yeah, I don't know. I think the problem really stems, honestly, now that I haven't thought about this before, Guthrie.
I think
it has to do with spending too much time of your day in one tool. I think we should mandate Figma breaks.
Well, but that's, I think that's part of it. You have this tool that's collaborative, and if everyone's in the tool together,
oh man,
how do you get out of it?
All right, now here's I have this question. I don't know the answer to this. I should ask some of the people I mentor. How much collaboration do they really do in Figma? I see people working by themselves. It's them and Figma. Now, definitely other people can access their files, but I don't know. How much of that is really going on versus just me and my Figma?
I think this is generally true just in companies generically, right? You have a lot of people who allegedly are going into the office so they can be more collaborative, and then they're going on, you know, Teams calls by themselves, you know, in the office around other
people.
Well,
I know. And the problem is that
that's been true
go
forever,
into the
right?
office, and then they try to find a conference room to be by themselves. They find a conference room to be by themselves because they need to have a video call with someone who's not in that office. And if they have the video call out in the main area, it's too noisy because everybody's having a video call with somebody else in the main. This is every day, Guthrie. This is every day I see this with our clients. Yeah, it's pretty. What I like is you're on a group call, and you know, you see everybody on the screen, right? But in the background of the screen is the backs of the other people that are whose front you see on the call. And then not only the front, then you get different views. So I have a front view and a side view and a back view of the same person.
I do feel like
it's weird.
I do feel like back in the day, this also happened though. People would be like having like a small meeting in person in their little areas. Though maybe it wasn't. Maybe there was like the cubicles where you worked on your stuff quietly. And then if you needed to have a loud conversation, you'd go to a conference room.
That's what used to happen. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You didn't used to go to a conference room to get on a video call with someone else.
I will say it is a downside of a lot of the Teams calls. There's something about
it. What?
Well, one person, like, so right now I'm in a room by myself and I can talk very loud, you know, and like, you know, so you're in this room where everyone is sort of talking in this loud voice, and something about the mic, like it's further away because it's in your laptop or something. I mean, right now, right, we have our mics
and we're talking really very close.
But for, you know, 9 times out of 10, you know, the mic's over there. And so like, you feel like you need to project in the same way that like, if someone was, you know, a couple feet away from you, you wouldn't whisper. That would be really weird. And so I feel like when people, if they needed to have a conversation back in the day, and I did work in an office, back in the day, you could walk over to someone and it's like, hey, so what's the deal with such and such?
Yeah.
You could have a quiet conversation.
Yeah.
You know, over your talking about, you know, gossiping about someone. And sometimes it would get a little loud, but if there was like a group having a conversation, I do feel like you could kind of have a quiet conversation, but like no one is having Teams calls where everyone's talking like this. And then one person's just like, yeah, you know, I think in Q4, we really need to focus on these other initiatives. Right. Whereas that would be totally fine in person, right? If you were trying not to disturb other people, but because other people aren't in that same room and everyone's talking loud, like it's a faux pas for you to do it. Okay, so that is to say that there are other areas in which you have this weird like working alone but togetherness aspect of the modern work environment. And in some ways, Figma is a perfect tool for that.
Well, you know, that's really interesting. All right. Wait, pause. Let's talk about design, and let's talk about collaborating in design with Figma. So I think in what I'm seeing is a lot of the collaboration is not real-time collaboration.
Right.
It's I go off and do my thing, and then I let you know that I've updated the blah, blah, blah file, and you go in on your machine and you look at what I did, right? And then you might make comments on it. And maybe we talk about it at the next meeting. But it's really not made for collaborative design in real time because, and this is not just Figma, all the tools have been like this for a long time. Because it's just one person is making the changes. You know, there's the whole idea of the design sprint, which is funny because the whole design sprint idea is making a comeback these days. And I find it really interesting. It's like people are like, we're going to do what? What? We're all going to get together in a room with a whiteboard. And we're going to design this together. And it's like, what? And because when you're designing like that, you know, that phrase, I don't even know where I got this phrase. Someone said to me once, I didn't make it up. The person with the pen has the power. So, you know, if you're designing collaboratively and you're in front of a whiteboard and everybody has a marker, that's collaborative design. If you're got people together in a room, but one person is running the Figma, that's not really the same. It's not the same. And everybody's just watching what that one person does as everyone talks. It's not bad. It's better than working alone, but it's not the same. And
yeah. Do you think, all right. So before you continue, can you say three nice things about Figma? I want you to, right? So, we're sort of we are only complaining because we've heard complaints from the UX community about it.
Yeah.
But in some ways, there are obviously benefits to working in Figma, which is why everyone does it. So, can you just pause and say how Figma makes doing UX easier? Three ways.
Well, some of them are going to be, you know, really obvious, but
that's okay. They can be obvious. It's like why does everyone like pizza? It's like cheese and sauce and bread. Like it's not, you know, it can be obvious. Just because it's obvious doesn't mean it's bad.
All right. So three good things about Figma. One would be it's really easy to make changes. So if you want to, you know, change something on a screen, it's really fast and easy to make changes. And number two would be, it's actually easy to make changes to not just the piece you're working on, but have that go through and, you know, you change that button on this screen, but because you've got it set up right, it changes that button on all the screens if you wanted to. So that's two. And then three, I guess I'm trying to think about like things that are unique to Figma, but I shouldn't do that. Three, I think it's relatively easy to use with design standards and build that in, bake that in.
Okay.
So that's three. Yeah, that
okay? I wanted to say that like we are.
I'm sure everybody would have a different three.
And because we are not anti-Figma.
No, I'm not anti-Figma at all.
But it's in some ways, this is a problem of its own success, right? This is too much of a good thing as a problem.
Well, we are all wondering, you know, these tools come and go, right? We know that.
And then there's really, it's double weird because Figma, because there was, I remember it was like 2015, and there was this huge, you know, hole in the market, which was for good prototyping software
right. That
could really take over UX. And Figma was one, and with Sketch was
another,
and then Adobe XD, and they all tried to take the market, and so it's this whole thing, and then Figma seemed to be kind of winning. Yeah. So then Adobe tried to buy them for $20 billion. And in doing so, this is the tool now, right?
Right.
Anyone who uses Adobe is going to be using Figma, which is a huge number of creative shops. And all the people who are going to be using Figma, going to keep using Figma. Right. And if you're using some smaller thing, well, you might as well get on Figma because that's going to be the industry standard.
Right.
Well, and then so it was done for like a year, and then suddenly antitrust comes, and it all falls apart.
It didn't happen.
But in that intervening year, Adobe XD basically got shut down. I don't even know if
you can everybody just went
download
to
it anymore. Right. So like there used to be sort of multiple tools and different people trying different stuff, and there was this huge kind of industry consolidation, and which is fine. I mean, it's the winner, and maybe it's the best, and maybe it won for good reasons. Sometimes I think products win for bad reasons. I think it probably won for good reasons, but now it's it's so successful, and it ties in so well with the workflows, or they've designed workflows to tie into it so well that, you know, that has become that is now what doing UX is using that program. And in some ways, there are other creative industries where this has happened. If you look at, I'm not an expert in this, but if you look at design, artistic design work, you know, logos and graphics, and
illustrations
and stuff. You know, it's not entirely true because there actually are a lot of competition out there. But in a lot of it did become just like learning how to use Illustrator in mm-hmm. some capacity. And it's maybe a little more complicated because there are actually a lot of, you know, other ways to do that depending on the work that you're doing. But there are certainly other industries where some piece of software has taken over. And so when you're in school, like, you don't learn how to do it, you just learn how to use the software because that's how you're actually doing it. Yeah. So, you know, it's not necessarily a knock. It's just too much of a good thing.
And part of it is the amount of time that you invest getting good at it, and then you're reluctant to let that go. You know, another industry, Guthrie, is the music composition and production industry, which has its own set of tools. And that's kind of an interesting one because there are a number of tools that are competing that have been around for a really long time. And so unlike Figma, where, you know, there's one tool that emerges as the tool in that industry, there's a number of different tools. They're all terrible. And people are very, you know, passionate about one tool or another, but it takes so long to learn how to use them because, in my opinion, they're so poorly designed that you're hesitant to invest the time to learn something else. I remember just recently, because, you know, I've been writing music, and I was in the studio and talking to the music producer, and he said something like, how come you don't? Oh, because I use this one tool to do one thing, but then a different tool to do the notation. And he was like, you know, you could use just the one tool for all of it. And I was like, oh, I know, but I kind of know how to use this other one. I've used it for so long. And just this resistance I have, because it's like, oh man, I just don't want to invest time in learning that tool over there. It's just, I'm just going to stick with what I'm doing because I know it. And so that's part of it too. You know, it takes a long time to learn how to use these tools effectively. They're complicated tools. Figma's complicated. Does a lot, but it is complicated.
Yeah. So let's we'll talk about downstream effects, and then we'll sort of wrap up unless you have more things that you want to say on the topic. So it seems that I'm calling it out now because it seems to only be accelerating, and I know there are another industry. I mean, you hear about software a lot of software programmers aren't super thrilled about their job because they just sort of feel like, you know, they're just,
well, you know,
they're drowning a little bit.
The term on the Figma side is if you're doing UX UI work, you're a screen monkey.
Right. Yeah.
And I'm sure they have the equivalent. Do you know what they call it? The software developers? Because they probably have that same feeling, right?
Yes. Yeah. No, exactly.
I'm just supposed to keep producing the same thing. You know, just keep producing. Yep.
And UX has gotten sucked into that pipeline. Yeah. And so they're just, but in some ways that's the value add, right? They are a gear now in the product production line, and the output is Figma screens. And so that is what the money for the UXer is going towards, is to create that product. It's become less of a consulting like ideas,
expertise,
and much more of a production career.
So
that's why everyone's trying to get into UX strategy, because it's like the last little island.
That's interesting. That requires that you be a human instead of a monkey.
Well, no, that you maybe get to work on more interesting, tougher questions.
Well, okay, and you know what I'm gonna bring up then.
You bring up whatever you want.
Well, because, you know, then comes the question, well, can't AI do all that part? Producing screens.
You would think so.
Yeah.
You would think that's going to come.
I would think that's got to be.
Well, it's so true. Like a lot of it, I feel like in the last 20 years, we've seen it in a lot of different, would you call UX a creative profession?
I would, yeah.
Yeah, creative professions. I mean, in some ways, you know, coding is a creative profession. We don't think about it, right? But that's a language. That's you're creating stuff. Anyway, so sort of that higher level, higher, more highly trained, you know, whatever, kind of white collar worker. But they are, I think, in the last 20 years, their work has been condensed into this output, right?
Yeah.
So if you're a coder, it's like, okay, how many bugs can you fix this quarter, right? It doesn't really, like, it's not, I mean, and maybe I don't know, all the real programmers would probably yell at me, but and maybe it's not even that. Maybe it's, you know, just, you know, how many, you know, lines of code are you just spitting out, and it's become kind of productized.
Yep.
And so it's generic, and what's your value add? It's the product. It's the output. It's not your input. It's just, as long as you have the output, that's all that matters. Yep. You know, raw coding hours. And in UX, right, it's sort of a similar thing. What's the value add? Well, it's just the screens, right? If we just need prototypes in Figma, that is, it's not about the input, it's about the raw output. And I think that's happened in a bunch of these sort of you could probably say the same about UX writing, you know, very copywriting kind of stuff. You could say the same about a lot of graphic design, you know, just, hey, we need an image, but it doesn't really matter. Yeah, social media marketing. That's a perfect one, right?
Posts. We need posts. We need 30 posts a week.
Right? We need 100,000 trillion billion posts a month. And,
right.
Right. And those are the industries where AI is terrifying to those industries, because what AI is really good at, or potentially could be really good at, is output.
Yeah.
Right. Like if you can make one mediocre Instagram post with software, it means you can probably, the cost for a human to make two is like 70% of the cost to make one.
Right.
And the cost of software to make two is like 1% of the cost to make one. Right?
Right.
So you can scale the output tremendously. Now, it doesn't necessarily help you if you valued the input, right? The process to get there, and that's a different conversation for, you know, can I?
Well, okay. That, so
right, but if UX if the value of UX is just making Figma screens, and that is the only just making screens that are good enough, then yeah, there's no way they could get automated away.
So here, I'll make a statement here. I think. And you know, I'm not, I mean, I don't want to get into this whole discussion about how I feel about AI, but let's just say I'm not necessarily a let's go fan of AI. However, I think if AI was the screen monkey, then I think the true value of UX might come back.
Well, but I mean, this is, you know, to tie us back to the beginning, there is some truth to that, right? Because on one hand, the vast majority of work that UXers are doing is just being screen monkeys in Figma, and they complain about that. On the other hand, UX research has never been bigger, and more people are doing that sort of analytical research, this stuff as well. And it's gotten tied into the marketing research, and it's sort of getting its claws in there. It's got tied into the big data analytics,
the product design.
So it's doing both things at once. It's becoming more important and more relied upon in a business context, and also at the same time, the majority of it is sort of potentially generic and obsolete in some capacity, that or easily replicable by software, not easily potentially replicable by software. Did you have anything to add about that particular point? Okay. So here, this is everyone's interesting AI thing of the week.
What?
So one of the potential problems is that originally they had these benchmarks for AI, like how accurately can you do X or Y, right? Yeah. And the problem is that a lot of those tests, they were basically maxing out at. So large language models now achieve 90% accuracy on most of the popular benchmarks, like MMLU, okay?
Yeah.
So these guys, which I think is the Center for AI Safety, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They created this new AI test to measure how powerful AI is. And it's called Humanity's Last Exam. And I encourage everyone to go to lastexam.ai to go check it out.
Okay. Lastexam.ai. All right.
Yeah, yeah. And so they created a new data set. They had 1,000 experts across 50 countries to come up with 3,000, I believe it's 3,000 questions. And these are like really challenging questions across over 100 subjects. So, you know, and the idea is that hopefully you couldn't train against it, but as long as the AI is not trained for this particular set, these should be questions that AI would be really bad at doing.
Oh, that's interesting. I definitely want to check that out.
So let me, give some examples. Okay. Yeah. Hummingbirds within Apophormes, Apodiformes, with a capital A, I'm assuming that's some sort of subset of hummingbirds, uniquely have bilaterally paired oval bone, a sesamoid embedded in the caudal lateral portion of the expanded colon, cruate apparatus of the insertion of the M. depressor caudae. How many paired tendons are supported by this sesamoid bone?
Well, the answer is 32. However,
okay, what, so that's an example.
But no human could answer that, so I don't understand.
No, that's where you're wrong.
A human could answer that.
Exactly. That's why it's humanity's last exam.
But most humans could not answer that.
Correct. But that's okay, right? The question is, like that, that's where AI starts to get, it's, you know, right now, like, okay, AI, like large language models, write a bad, you know, poem, right? A 50 word poem about a shoe, right? It can do that. Most humans can do that. Okay.
Yeah.
That's fine. It's not, you know, traditionally we're talking about being generic and not exceptional. There's a lot of generic work, and we just talked about some of the stuff that's maybe like a step higher than generic, right? But like generic Figma prototype that looks like all the other websites on the world, like that is something that theoretically you could do. So this is where things get interesting, because humanity's last exam, like these are really hard questions that humans can answer. There's like a couple of them, right? But it's at like the highest end of each profession.
You have to think about,
right? And so if AI can actually answer all of these correctly, now it is actually smarter than humanity, because we're doing like, right, like this is like, you know, a couple humans could maybe,
so then we should just go play.
I disagree with you a little bit, because if you are a smart academic researcher, which you are,
thank you,
right, you could, what if I gave you 2 weeks or a month and a database, and I said, okay, here's everything you need to know about hummingbirds, go do the research the anatomy, come up with your conclusions. Like you could probably figure that particular one. Here's a simpler question. Okay.
Yeah.
In Greek mythology, who was Jason's maternal great grandfather?
Okay. I'm really not good with Greek mythology,
but it doesn't matter. Right. But but if I gave you all the history of Greek mythology,
but blah, AI blah, could do it if you gave it all the history of Greek mythology.
Honestly, that one's probably pretty tough, actually, because don't forget some of the parents were mountains, and like they were like, you know, like the sea. Okay, here's another one. A block is placed on a horizontal rail along which it can slide frictionlessly. It is attached to the end of a rigid massless rod, length R. A mass is attached at the other end. Both objects have weight W. The system is, you know, blah, 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 blah. So the question is, the rod is horizontal, it carries tension. What is the value of T1 minus T2 divided by
I did not do well in physics. So.
Well, so anyway, I encourage everyone, if you want, you can go check out
That's funny, Guthrie.
Humanity's Last Exam. Very, very interesting. And
just to give an example, because I won't be able to answer any of the questions.
So like ChatGPT 4.0,
yeah,
its accuracy is about 3%.
Oh, good. Now, right? That does make me feel
better. But 0.3 mini high is 13%, right? So it's already making leaps, but it's like the next. Anyways, all right. So that's it. We should probably wrap up.
All right. Guthrie, but, people
any other thoughts about this particular topic?
No, it's an interesting topic. I don't have any other thoughts right now. We'd love to hear from people.
Keep an eye on it. We'll see how the industry goes.
Write to us if you have ideas. And how can people reach us, Guthrie?
Info@theteamw.com. I'm saying one of the things we're doing for 25 is re-sprucing our socials. Hopefully we'll have some more
content. Social media.
I'm not saying it's going to be high level stuff. We're of course continuing to work on our book. We're going to have good blog posts that we as humans actually write. But hopefully we can have package that some of that stuff in more entertaining and interesting ways. So,
thanks.
Oh, last thing, if anyone wants to work with us, you can get in touch as we're planning stuff for the summer.
Yeah, we're planning.
I don't know if anyone will hear
2025 work, right?
The summer stuff. So, get in touch. Otherwise, I hope everyone has a great week, and we'll talk to you soon.
Bye.